This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to turn our attention to matters related to digestion and the microbiome. We're calling upon one of our perennial experts. She's Marty Whittakin. She's a board-certified clinical nutritionist, having counseled for 33 years. She's also host of her own nationally syndicated weekly nutrition talk radio show, quite popular, called Healthy by Nature. Now in its 19th year, she's author of some great books, The Probiotic Cure, Natural Alternatives to Nexium, Malox, Tagamet, Prilosec, and other acid blockers. That is so timely because, Marty, years ago, you foresaw the problems that now are only now emerging with the use of these chronic acid-suppressing medications. She also has written a book on aloe vera. Modern science sheds light on an ancient herbal remedy. And she has taken issue with the low-fat diet craze in a book called Fat-Free Folly. So she's right in my wheelhouse for sure. She has served as president of the National Nutritional Foods Association during the time when they passed the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. That's really important. She also helped found Texans for Health Freedom to protect citizens' access to alternative medical treatment in Texas and led the group to victory as president. She's a frequent guest on national TV and radio programs. And I'm just running out of time, you know, listing all your accolades.
I got to send you a shorter intro. That was lovely, though.
There's actually a couple of things here that I wanted to circle back on because in talking to you in the past, you know, we've talked about the microbiome and we've talked about probiotics, and you're certainly quite an expert on those subjects. But you also have areas of expertise that I want to touch upon during today's interview. Your website, healthybynatureshow.com, we'll mention that so the people can access your radio program as well because there are podcasts posted there. Before we get to the core of our subject, which is diversity, we'll tantalize our listeners a little bit with that because diversity is a big buzzword in America these days. We're all about diversity. But diversity is important for yet another reason related to gastrointestinal health. But I was intrigued that you helped to found Texans for Health Freedom down there in Texas. Could you briefly outline what the struggle was all about in Texas?
Unfortunately, it's a struggle that continues today. It just takes on a different look, but it's the medical association, the old hardliners of conventional medicine. They circle the wagons and they don't want competition from naturopaths or from doctors who are practicing what I consider the most intelligent medicine, like Dr. Hoffman does, where you incorporate the best of science with what makes sense from the alternative and the natural medicine and herbal medicine and what works in other countries and so on. They like the standard pharmaceutical medicine that they learned in medical school. And so they too often will call somebody down to Austin. And these poor doctors have done nothing wrong. It's not because of a complaint. Almost never is it a complaint from a patient. It's a complaint from one of their competitors. Mm. And these doctors would end up spending a couple $100,000 and waste a lot of time and gain a lot of stress just trying to defend themselves. And so what we did at that time was create a little bit of a safe haven that if you did an informed consent form and you followed some guidelines, you could venture away from the beaten path. Mm-hmm. But it still goes on today. It just changes what they get annoyed by. I mean, at one time it was they didn't like acupuncture. There's anything that was new that they didn't learn in medical school that wasn't supported by the pharmaceutical companies was suspect.
And indeed, there was a big dust-up with Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski down in Texas out of Houston, who is a very innovative cancer practitioner who incurred the wrath of the Texas Medical Board for deviating from standard cancer protocols in administering antineoplastins. We've covered that story here on Intelligent Medicine. But it seems to me, you know, Texas is an interesting state because on the one hand, it's very medically oriented. You know, we got the big cancer hospitals, MD Anderson, and we've got, you know, some really Baylor Medicine, you know, fabulous bastions of medicine in Texas. On the other hand, the Texans tend to be a little ornery. They're independent-minded. They're somewhat libertarian in their outlook, and they don't brook a lot of interference from government bureaucrats. And I think that's what is at the core of this health freedom issue.
And that's why the underground is so important, because people have to make the choices, but then also support them of what makes sense to them and put together the protocol and that team of practitioners that makes sense. But the Texas Medical Association, the kind of the Texas JAMA, they are the most powerful lobby group, second only to trial lawyers. And so when they don't want something, they can just squish it like a bug. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody gets crosswise of one of them, you probably find this amusing. This is a supplement maker, but it's an example of what happens when the government doesn't like you. I have no idea what his original infraction was. It was some minor kind of thing, but he's sassy, and he sassed somebody. Well, next thing you knew, he had the FDA, the Texas Department of Health, he had OSHA, he had the tax audit, he had even alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, because he used a bottle of vodka as the basis of something in a sinus spray. So they can really get after you. And if you've got all the big money of Texas Medical Association behind you, that's why so many doctors that I have the greatest respect for operate very quietly, because they just don't want to make waves. And it's just sad when we're looking at the disease care system that we have and how it threatens to bankrupt the country, that we can't all get along and take the best of each. It's just... It isn't just Texas. I mean, I'm sure it's mm-hmm. the same kind of thing.
Yeah, we spearheaded a similar effort here in New York in the 1980s and early 1990s, because it was actually considered illegal per se to practice alternative medicine. And at least we got the right to offer alternatives. That doesn't necessarily mean that doctors who practice alternative medicine don't get called up on charges frequently. Because, well, there's still this prejudice against natural medicine, but this has made New York a little bit of a safer state for patients and doctors to collaborate on natural medicine.
Well, you have some funny rules there about what you can test for. I've run into
that's
that
for sure. We still have too. That. We still there. You're way ahead of us in terms of your ability to order tests. In fact, some of the companies that do the best testing for chemical exposure are based in Texas, but we can't in New York State access those tests, because I guess the theory is that if New Yorkers were to become aware of how laden they were with chemicals, there would be a big outcry. So we're not allowed to check our patients for chemical exposures.
Well, and then they'd want to do something about it.
Exactly. So. Exactly. And that wouldn't be good. So, so let's kind of just keep sweeping under the rug. All right. So moving along to a different topic that I wanted to touch base with you on, because I'm fascinated by the potential of aloe vera in terms of as a GI remedy. And the problem that I have with aloe vera is that it's, you got to have the right aloe vera, because if you use the wrong aloe vera, from what I understand, it can cause side effects. Aloe vera is a great laxative. You may not want that property into your aloe, but it's also a wonderful anti-inflammatory, great for stomach problems and reflux and GERD. So tell us a little bit about the potential of aloe for healing.
Well, it has been used for thousands of years. Most people are more aware of its use for burns and abrasions and that kind of thing. But you're exactly right. If a person takes an aloe vera leaf, throws it in a blender and drinks it, they're going to be in big trouble, because in the peeling, there's a yellow sap that is very caustic. It actually wouldn't want it on your skin. It kills skin cells. And I would never recommend an aloe vera laxative to anybody, because it's very, very harsh and damaging. It's just not the way we want to
habit
get
forming as well. Yeah.
Yes. But now most of the companies that make liquid aloe to drink have removed all of that aloin in the yellow sap, and so you don't get a laxative effect from it. But unfortunately, most of them also damage the healing ability of the aloe when they make it, because of the kind of filtration and enzymes and things they use. They break these long chains of polysaccharides that are the key that unlocks things. They break it down into simple sugars that don't have those benefits. So I, in my book, I list a number of them. Most of them
that's
are
the natural alternatives to Nexium, Maalox, Tagamet, Prilosec, and other acid blockers. That book.
I mentioned it in all the books.
In aloe, and also there's a book entitled Aloe Vera: Modern Science Sheds Light on an Ancient Herbal Remedy. That one too.
Now the easiest one, and I'm not paid by the company, but if it's okay to mention it,
please go. Yeah.
Lily of the Desert is the one I know does it right. I mean, they put a refrigerated truck in the field, so as soon as they cut the leaves, it becomes refrigerated. Mm-hmm. They control the process all the way to the bottling. So they have, university test shows that they have the heaviest and the most rich assortment of the polysaccharides, so you're just going to get a lot more benefit. And it's right in the middle of the price range. It's not like it's the most expensive one either. So, so virtually every health food store in the country has it, so it's not hard to come by.
So there's also the option to get either pills, you know, that, you know, are freeze-dried aloe, versus aloe juice, versus aloe gel, which is kind of gloppy. I always tell patients to take the aloe gel, because to my mind, it's more concentrated and potentially more healing. And it also may adhere more to the lining of the esophagus and the stomach. Am I on the right track there?
Mostly. I mean, here's the thing. I recommend the gel also when somebody's trying to heal the esophagus if they've had acid reflux, because it does stick better. But it's made thick by adding something like Irish moss. It's an additive, because if you take the gel out of the middle of an aloe,
which is kind of like carrageenan, right? That's carrageenan is the derivative of those kind of seaweeds, right?
Yes. Because aloe will digest itself into a liquid, and so then they have to thicken it back up again. And if you you want the most potency, you get one where they use the whole leaf, but then they remove that yellow sap because there's some other benefits in the peeling. And that same company makes a really good digestive remedy that helps balance stomach acid. It's called Stomach Formula. But that's something that you use for short term, but for daily use, an aloe, there's one that I like the best is in glass, and it's organic, and has no preservatives. So
because the preservatives are irritating for some people. They sometimes, even when they use vitamin C as a preservative, it's a little irritative to people who have inflamed mucosa in the gastrointestinal lining.
Well, I mean, as you know, just with, like with food, we want things that are going to rot. We just want to get there before it does.
Yeah, exactly. So it has to be fresh. Freshness is an issue. So the pills, do they count for anything? Do they offer any benefits? Say, you know, if you're trying to deal with a lower down problem, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, do you think those can be swallowed and they'll reach the proper site of action? Are they, once they're freeze-dried, is it active or is it neutralized?
I'm thinking that probably most of them have been damaged before it was dried. I haven't seen one that I like. I haven't been looking for one, so mm-hmm. there may be some that are good. I just think it's probably way less expensive, and we know it works to drink the aloe and maybe work with probiotics to help straighten out the environment in that part of the world.
Okay, so that's a good segue to our topic, and I'll introduce our topic with a story that just crossed my desk today, and it has to do with, let's see if I have it here, it has to do with the relationship between microbial diversity in the gastrointestinal tracts of infants and their intelligence. Whoa, that sounds pretty thought-provoking. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I haven't seen that one yet, so that is pretty exciting. Well, once we come to grips with how much our bacteria do for us, I ran across something just recently, too, that kind of paints this picture, that after they've finished doing the human genome project, they expected to find 100,000 genes. Now the estimate's down to 19,000, which is, well, like half of what a fruit fly has. Where's the rest of this information coming from? Some of it's coming from some mysterious dark matter around the cells, but a whole lot of it comes from our bacteria. They make things that help us, help our nervous system, and in this case, brain. They make neurotransmitters and vitamins and organic acids and all these different kinds of things. And each breed, each species of bacteria has a different specialty. So the more different kinds you have, the more beneficial substances they make. So they will undoubtedly, there will be any number of grants or millions of dollars thrown at that question until they can really nail it down exactly which bacteria is making which thing that's going to make the kiddo smarter. But just in general, and when I wrote that book, I looked at maybe 1,000 abstracts, and the clear message was usually you get better results with a mixture of bacteria rather than even one or two of the best. So that it kind of fits in, but I hadn't seen it with intelligence. I've seen it with blood sugar management, mm-hmm. with asthma, and with not getting upper respiratory infections and so on. But that's a new one. That's pretty exciting.
I'll send it to you. It's and I'll put it up on our website, and I'm sure you'll discuss it on one of your podcasts and maybe feature it on your website.
Definitely will use.
They say this is the first time an association between microbial communities and cognitive development has been demonstrated in humans. This comes to us from a dispatch of today, July 24th, 2017. Infant gut bacteria link with smarter toddlers. Studies published in Biological Psychiatry, it was found that infants with high levels of the bacteria type Bacteroides at age one subsequently performed better in cognitive tests a year later. And an additional unexpected discovery was that infants with highly diverse gut microbiomes performed well. And so, you know, this is diversity seems to be a prerequisite for health, for brain health, for optimal health in general.
And that really brings us back to what happened before that. How did these kiddos get diversity? And one of the things that I talk about in the probiotic cure is my concern that now when we're delivering, what, something like a third of babies by C-section, not only do they not pass through the birth canal and pick up the bacteria that they would from the mom, because the mom is going to be in surgery, that she's usually given back antibiotics before, she's given antibiotics afterwards, those come through in the breast milk, kid's more likely to get sick, he's going to get more antibiotics, and so we're just killing them off left and right. And you add to that our preoccupation with sterilizing, pasteurizing, sanitizing everything in sight. How are they supposed to get diversity? We don't eat fermented foods. We don't have our kids living on Amish farms where they're in touch with farm animals. We know there's a there, but boy, what are we going to do about it? It starts to be a real question.
Indeed. There's a guy who, he's an anthropologist or he's an anthropology writer, and he did this experiment where he lived with a hunter-gatherer tribe in the Amazon for a few months. And the thrust of his research was to study the microbial diversity of his poop. What he did is he started by checking his own poop, and it was like, not so hot in terms of diversity on his, albeit a fairly decent Western diet. Then he checked the indigenous natives and found that they had tremendous diversity. But after he spent a while living in that environment, perhaps sharing their flora to some extent just by being in that environment, the germs, the natural germs in that environment, but also eating the diet, which is a very high-fiber diet, he managed to approximate the microbial diversity of the indigenous natives. So, clearly this is not predetermined. It's not too late to alter your microbial diversity. It's something that can be a goal that can be attained by people who even had some of the worst antecedents, too many antibiotics, C-section, no breastfeeding, and a crappy standard American diet.
Well, exactly. I have a problem thinking about moving out into the bush because I probably wouldn't get Wi-Fi, so that's going to be a problem for me.
Right.
So we might have to find, what are the ways we can stay in cities and still aim to have more diversity.
Mm-hmm. Well, so for these natives, for example, they don't need Dr. Hira's probiotics to have microbial diversity. But, as a compromise, I think that's it's a bit of an artificial intervention. Although the way that this particular product works is it works more like a functional food, more like a fermented food, than a standard probiotic. This is a good point at which to pause because I want to talk more about probiotics and tap your extensive background in studying probiotics and introduce the interesting concept of the postbiotic. That's a fascinating concept, and I believe you coined the term, and I want you to explain it when we return. Today we're talking to Marty Whittakin. Marty Whittakin's a board-certified clinical nutritionist, and she's got her own radio program. You can find it at healthybynatureshow.com. She's written several books, The Probiotic Cure, I recommend very highly, Aloe Vera, Modern Science Sheds Light on an Ancient Herbal Remedy, and Natural Alternatives to Nexium. We'll take a look at those books as well in part two. Stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.